feel the way a lot of us in California feel every day. And that's where I'm from. So come and visit. It's really a good place. We're an isolated little island where sanity and innovation prevails. And there are a few other spots left. And I don't have any financial... Is this the advance?
Yeah, just press the left.
The left, sorry. Didn't get my, I don't have any financial relationships to disclose, but obviously I have some emotional ones, which I have just shared with you. Let me tell you what I am going to try to do, and I'll it really put healthcare reform in the context of thinking about health workforce needs, health workforce broadly, but I'm really going to focus on the public health workforce specifically. We're going to have a wonderful opportunity later in plenary today to hear from the HRSA administrator, Mary Wakefield, but as HRSA says, so it must be true, we have a national shortage of many types of workers in our health professional armamentarium, whether it's physicians, nurses, public health professionals, pharmacists, and the like. And we also have a challenge that those workforce shortages are coming against a really profound economic recession, so that some, certainly in the public health workforce, some of the needs for these workers are not being well met because of the decreasing ability at the state and local level to actually hire the folks who are sorely needed. I'm going to focus, though, in these comments, really looking more directly at the public health workforce. We've had a few important reports that came out of the Institute of Medicine earlier in this decade. Looking at the overall need for well-trained public health professionals, one specifically who will keep the public healthy, tried to talk about the quality and preparedness, recognizing that it's not simply a numbers of inadequacy, but we need people well-trained in the right places doing the right thing. And to follow on Regina's previous comments, we recognized in that IOM report in which I was engaged that public health education was not just for the health professional at the highest level of training, but that public health education was really something we need to do for our citizenry and starting at K through 12 all the way up, and something we should think about integrating. Well, the public health workforce is hard to grapple with as a single number. It's, as you know, because you're all in it, it involves lots of people in different job titles over here working in lots of different sectors. And there have been attempts over the years to try to enumerate and catalog the public health workforce, and I think one of the things we'll see as a true benefit out of the healthcare reform legislation is a more organized and comprehensive effort to do that. A few attempts have been made, though, to try to do specific workforce shortage assessments. There's a general conventional wisdom, we don't have enough public health workers, and then the question is, what does that mean in terms of actual numbers, which, because you need numbers to guide policymakers to fund and the like. One effort a few years ago from the Institute of Medicine looked specifically at physicians. They used a tried and true metric, which is to come up with a standard physicians per population basis. And based on that, they said that there is a need for 20,000 physicians in public health careers, and we only had 10,000 currently, so therefore there's a 10,000 physician gap just for physicians' dedicated primary activity in public health. The Association for Schools of Public Health, which represents all the accredited schools of public health in the country now, about 46, with about six more online, actually tried to do a broader effort to assess and quantify the shortage, and again using the same concept, which is a metric of using a per population basis. If we just tried to get back to where we were in 1980, which was better than we are now on a per population basis, the estimate would be that we are short by 2020 of approximately 250,000 against a baseline workforce of about 500,000. So, shortages, rather significant, and interestingly, because a lot of you are working in the trenches and you know from your colleagues, you're all very young in this audience, but you know from your colleagues around you that we have an aging cohort of a workforce. These estimates were totally independent of the expected retirements that would be coming online with this aging workforce. We've been able to extrapolate those estimates on a state-by-state basis, and a lot of this information is available, by the way, if you go to the ASPH.org website, you can find it, to try to get a feel of what that means, and I believe that there have been positive state experiences advocating for increased investment in public health workforce based on these more local rather than national numbers. But the Association of Schools of Public Health didn't want to just quantify the shortage. That was reasonably well accepted that there was one. They tried to say, well, what would be some good recommendations leading up to this last year of healthcare reform opportunities? We had a vested interest. The vested interest is our business is training graduate students. So we said we have a role here to play in training more graduate students. But we also recognize the role for doing continuing education for the existing workforce, expanding and addressing the remarkable enthusiasm at the undergraduate level for public health training, some of the most popular undergraduate majors in some of the major universities around the country. And we also felt and identified something that I think sometimes gets lost, which is the physicians, because they're a bigger, heavier clout, the sort of 800-pound gorilla in our academic medical centers, often in terms of securing funding, such as the first $250 million out of the prevention funding. There is, though, a real need to do dual training. And the IOM committee identified that somewhere between 25 and 50% of all physicians should have the equivalent of master's level training in public health. I think that's a reasonable conclusion. So there needs to be the training then of the physicians as they come up, even if they are not primarily doing public health careers as we defined it, to have that broad-based population level prevention focused education. And I believe in that dual training is a lot of opportunities, and the dual training is not just public health and the physician workforce, but of course public health, the nursing workforce, the veterinary workforce, and other professions who are interacting significantly with healthcare and healthcare delivery. It takes money to do that. There's no question about it. I'll go through that very quickly, but it also takes some new thinking about how we're going to educate folks as well. And I know that all of us in this room and this organization and the ones we associate with recognize the importance, particularly as we're expanding and growing a workforce, to use these as opportunities, whether it's in the physician workforce, public health, nursing, or the like, to be able to increase a diversity to provide better quality service and care to our communities and individuals. Let me then quickly turn to what we saw in the Affordable Care Act, at least going into November, and just make a couple of comments about moving forward. We really, I think, as a community, have a lot to be pleased about. I know we all wanted more. Most of us wanted the Senate version of this bill for very good reason. It wouldn't have been $1 billion in the startup. It would have been more. It would have been higher, the funds going up not to $2 billion, but to many-fold that. But nonetheless, even with the compromises that were necessary to get it through, there was a recognition of workforce needs. There was a recognition of maldistribution, the need to improve education and training and workforce data. And a number of very significant health workforce provisions are included in the Affordable Care Act, the National Healthcare Workforce Commission, and you can see going down the line. Since I wanted to focus really on the public health provisions, I'm going to just hit on the top three of these, but I do believe there are significant overlaps, and primary care physicians do play a role for the public's health and population health. We'd like them to play an even stronger one. So I'm of the camp that says we need to strengthen this workforce as well, but I think for direct public health workforce, we'll look at a few other provisions and how we prevailed. The National Health Care Workforce Commission was announced just at the end of September with 15 members, many of whom are active members in this professional association. They're given a broad charge in terms of making recommendations about priorities, looking at workforce needs, looking at barriers for coordination, and actually, I think, doing what we've all thought need to be done, having a more systematic way for enumerating this workforce and coordinating it as these health workforce data came forward. So we have, as a corollary to that, a National Center for Health Workforce Analysis, now in Health and Human Services, working with state and regional centers to analyze needs, health workforce development grants, and specifically some real advances in the public health workforce funding, whether it was a significant loan repayment program, which was authorized, mid-career training, new academic health center tracks that aren't just going to support medical students, but also supporting public health training as well, new fellowship programs. Of course, many of these are authorized and not appropriated, and that is an issue we always need to be vigilant about. We've seen this slide a number of different ways on different axes, but I think we all put it up here because the fact that we actually, even though it might have been $15 billion or more, the fact that we have $2 billion that's actually to be appropriated through this legislation as new funding for prevention and public health is important. We know the attacks on it began even before this election, and they will continue. I think you've heard enough about how that money got spent. There was some specific money that did go to public health training as well as public health infrastructure as well as the primary care sort of one-time raid, which we've been promised was a one-time raid. I really want to close these comments with a couple of thoughts. I think it would be a shame, and we have to be vigilant, we have to advocate, we need money, we need all these things. I also think we have to take advantage of this window of opportunity to do some serious rethinking about the way we're educating health professionals. I think we need much more serious dialogue about interprofessional education, and that's beyond the dual training I was just talking about. I think within our professions, we need to be much more nimble and creative than we've been, and certainly we're having those discussions within preventions. The Association of Schools of Public Health is looking at schools of the 21st century. This sort of summarizes some of the elements. I think we've achieved a number of key elements for beginning this discussion, and I'd love to have our associations and our professional groups figure out new ways to be creative in this domain. And I really don't, on the public health realm, want to lose sight, in the same way that I know a lot of us feel the current economy wreaked havoc on this last election cycle. It's wreaking havoc on our field, and we have to be really smart about how we try to address that at the same time. So thanks very much.
And happily, Vinny doesn't have any slides. I think he has some radio spots to play, right? Okay, right on, Vinny.
Thank you, Rob. It's a great pleasure for me to be here, distinguished panelists I'm with, and to be here with all of you. I love coming to APHA, and Denver's a great place. It's a lot warmer than Baltimore, let me tell you that. I was shocked with my heavy coat coming from Baltimore. Well, I'm Vinny DeMarco, and I've had a great privilege and honor over the last 20 years to work on public health issues of reducing gun violence, teen smoking, and underage drinking, and expanding health care. It's been a great privilege and honor for me. And as Rob said, we know that the vast majority of people support the public policies that we know work to accomplish these goals, but we know not everybody does. And I ran into an example of that 20 or 30% that opposes us when I went to my local community organization in Northeast Baltimore City to ask them to support a tobacco tax increase reduce teen smoking. They had supported programs to reduce gun violence, and I was making a proposal, and this really big guy at the front of the audience got up and said, "Aren't you the guy who came after my guns? Now you're trying to take away my cigarettes. Next thing I know, you're coming after my ham." And I assured him we were going to leave his ham alone. I didn't tell him I was a vegetarian because he probably would have shot me. But he represents the kind of people who think that we're the public health Nazis, the nanny state. But they are a distinct minority. The overwhelming majority of the public strongly support what we do. The problem is there are powerful vested interest opposition to us who make a lot of money off the status quo, who block the proposals that we put forward. Now, I'm not going to talk today a lot about the the advocacy that we use to overcome these obstacles. But I can refer you to that book that that Rob mentioned, The DeMarco Factor, which I can brazenly urge you to buy since I don't make a penny off it. It all goes to Mike Perchik, all those pennies. But Mike Perchik's going to be here this weekend, and he and I are going to be talking about the book tomorrow at 2:30 at the Public Mart. So come on over and meet Mike and hear about it. But there are six steps in this process that I just want to highlight for you, and then talk about what I'm supposed to talk about. But the six steps, which you'll read a lot about if you read this book, are: one, find out good public health-based proposals that address the problems you're trying to reach, cigarette taxes, et cetera, and find them out, figure them out, and they're there. Number two is do good polling, public interest surveys, to find out where the public is on your issue and how strongly they support what you're trying to do. Number three, and this is very important, build a powerful, broad-based coalition and bring the faith community involved. I've had the privilege to work with Faith United Against Tobacco, and Barbara Baylor from the UCC, one of our key founders, is here, and we brought together faith leaders from across the political spectrum to help get the FDA regulation of tobacco and many other successes. Number four, use the media to the hilt. The earned media, the paid media, I like to call it, and Barbara will tell you that I use the media, I use the telephone and email a lot, but I can't talk to 5 million Marylanders, so I think of the media as a giant telephone, a way to reach out to everybody. And fifth is to make your issue an election issue, and sixth is to do what you need to do to get the bill passed. But if you do those six steps and you do them right, you can overcome vested interest opposition. And let me tell you, you know, a lot of people are in a funk about this election this week, and there's reason to be upset, but I can tell you that we can make progress no matter what, because the vast majority of the public is with us. In 1997, when we started our campaigns to increase the cigarette tax and expand health care in Maryland, there was no obstacles higher than what we were facing. Absolutely, we were told, you can't pass a cigarette tax in Maryland. No way, under any, anybody here from Maryland? Hello, Marylanders. We were told we can't pass a cigarette tax ever. The obstacles were too high. Don't do it, just get lost. Well, we came together with the faith community, everybody else. We passed cigarette tax not only in 1999, but also in 2002 and 2007. And as a result, Maryland's cigarette smoking rate has dropped 32%, double the national average. 32% drop in smoking. Double the national average, resulting in 70,000 fewer deaths due to tobacco-caused illness and $2 billion saved in health care costs. And this only happened because we put together this public health coalition, which you could read about in Mike Perchik's book. So what do we do when you pass legislation? That's what I want to talk mostly about today, is once you pass something, and in addition to getting the smoking rate dropped, we use the money to significantly expand health care. We passed in 2007 a health care expansion that expanded health care to over 200,000 uninsured Maryland parents, children, and seniors, dramatically expanding health care coverage in Maryland, funded by that tobacco tax increase. After we accomplished all these things, I think there are three very important things to do once you pass a major new health care or public health law, which we need to do for the federal law also. Number one, I like to call brag and thank. Do a lot of letting the public know how great it is. Brag to the public, do press conferences, do ads, and thank those legislators who worked hard and the executives who work hard to get it done. When we passed our tobacco tax increase and health care expansion in 2007, we bought a full-page ad in the Baltimore Sun thanking Governor O'Malley and the Maryland General Assembly for doing it, and tell them they did a great job and they're going to save lots of lives. You know, some people, I don't understand why, don't like to thank legislators and governors who do good things for them. They are humans. They like to be patted on the back. They like to be thanked. Sometimes you have to spank them, but when you can thank them, do it. And do it in any way you can. We also held press conferences from one end of the state to the other to celebrate our healthcare expansion. Now, we were fortunate in Maryland, and it took a lot of work to get this done, but our healthcare expansion passed in a bipartisan way. unlike the federal law, we had Democrats and Republicans voting for it. So we made sure we go from one end of the state to the other, thanking Democrats and Republicans and highlighting their support for it. In Western Maryland, in the mountains of Western Maryland, a very Republican area, we held a press conference with Delegate Wendell Beitzel, a great guy, a conservative, but he voted for the bill. He was there, and we invited to come to that press conference this woman named Crystal Moon. And Crystal Moon told us that she, over the years, didn't have health care. Her husband had a full-time job. They couldn't afford health care. She went to the local health officers and said, look, I know that you have this program for kids. Can you insure them under the state program? And they said, Ms. Moon, there's now a program that you can get health care too that Governor Martin O'Malley just signed. She didn't know about it. She signed up. She got her new card and the law we just got enacted. A few weeks later, she was feeling ill. If she didn't have that health care coverage, she would have tried to sleep it off. Instead, she went to a doctor, and a doctor said, Ms. Moon, thank goodness you came here. If you hadn't come here, you were developing something that would have killed you. So she came to our press conference, and she said to Republican Delegate Wendell Beitzel and to all of us, thank you for saving my life. And that was featured in the local paper. And that's the kind of work we did all across the state to highlight the benefits of this new law and to thank the people. That's number one, brag and thank. Number two, get involved in the implementation. Get involved with the rules that have to be adopted, with everything that has to be done to make sure the law is fully implemented. And now that's very important for the federal health care law. Luckily, in Maryland, we have a governor who, by the way, was just overwhelmingly reelected in November against an opponent who opposed the health care law. So we in Maryland like federal health care reform. And the Governor O'Malley created a coordinating council who's going to fully implement federal reform in Maryland, but they can't do it alone. So we're fully engaged. And they've created work groups. Anybody from Maryland can go to healthreform.maryland.gov and find out what's going on and put in your input. Put in your input. Right now they're listening. They're having meetings. They have six different work groups. We're involved in each of them, and we're going to them and helping them figure out what is the best way to create the exchange, what's the best way to do insurance reform, what is the best way to do these things in a way that fully implements the law and is best for Maryland consumers. So get engaged in that process. Just because the law passed, your job's not done. Get engaged in that process. Number three, and this is a very, 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 very important, is to educate the public about the expansion. One of the things that's very important to understand is that we live and breathe this, right? So we know this great law passed. You can sign up. But there are average people out there who would benefit from the law who have no idea it passed. No matter how many times it's in that newspaper, no matter how many times you're screaming from the rooftops to your friends, they haven't heard about it, and they need to know about it, the people who are eligible for the new expansion. When our law passed, Maryland in 2007 had one of the lowest Medicaid rates in the country. We were 44th in the country. To be eligible for Medicaid, you had to be making less than $8,000 a year for a family of four if you were the parent. Abysmal. We expanded that to 116% of poverty, $25,000 a year. About 65 or 70,000 parents were eligible. But the state estimated, based on prior experience, that only 25,000 people would enroll. Well, they estimate only 25,000 people enroll because people just don't know about it. They're going about their busy lives, especially if you're lower income. You got a lot going on. You just don't know. We decided that was unacceptable. So we got some grants to launch a major program of outreach to let people know about this new law. And I'm very proud to say that as a result, in Maryland now, over 65,000 parents are enrolled. Virtually, we think, the whole universe. And in fact, we just published this new document, Faces of Maryland's Newly Insured, that tells 40 stories, including the story of Crystal Moon, that tells the stories of these people who are insured and how important it is. And this is a book where we're going to use very much in the legislature. But how did we do that? And this is what I want to emphasize here for a second. You got to work hard on this, and you can reach out to foundations who are concerned or worried about advocacy and say, this isn't advocacy. This is letting people know about something which is there and getting them enrolled. So we raised enough money. We went out there and we had people in the community, we had posters, and we did something that I think was very, very effective. We put together radio ads featuring our governor, Martin O'Malley, and stars from the Baltimore Ravens and the Washington Redskins, football stars. And with the football stars, they were out there doing these radio ads. I'm going to play them for you, but let me tell you first, I realized how effective these ads were when the one with Martin O'Malley and Ed Reed from the Ravens, I'm a football agnostic, which is very unpopular in my household. So when I asked the Ravens who should they use, they said Ed Reed, and I'd never heard of him, which is embarrassing. And I said to my son, Tony, who's 18 years old, what do you think, Ed Reed? Dad, he's my favorite, he's great. I was thrilled. So we ran this radio ad with Martin O'Malley, the governor, and Ed Reed, and that day I was parking my car and I heard these couple of attendants down a little bit far from me saying, "Hey, did you hear Ed Reed today talking about healthcare?" That's when I knew we had made some penetration. So we ran these ads, and we were out there in the community following up. And the success of these ads came from three things, as you'll hear. One, having a governor. Two, having Ed Reed. And three, using a 311 or 211 number so that people could easily access how to get, once they hear the ad, you don't have to remember an 800 number, just 311 or 211. So let me try, see if I can play these two ads. We had some technical issues before, but, okay. The computer.
Sing a little bit while
I... She wants me to sing.
Should it be Volare?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, here we go. We're gonna try to play this ad. Okay.
So I know it's important for everyone to have health coverage.
That's right, Chris. And that's why Maryland started a new program to make a lot more people eligible for quality.
It's not coming through the speakers, is it?
Including doctor's visits.
I've needed that.
Medical procedures.
I've needed that.
And prescription drugs.
That too.
Thousands of Marylanders can get quality health coverage just by signing up. And there's a special number for Maryland. Just call 211 to find out if you and your family are eligible.
Call 211.
I'm
Chris Sanders, offensive tackle for the Washington Redskins.
And I'm Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley.
We're here to talk about health care. I get a few bruises during the season, maybe some cuts, a broken bone, so I know it's important for everyone to have health coverage.
That's right, Chris. And that's why Maryland started a new program to make a lot more people eligible for quality health care, including doctor's visits.
I've needed that.
Medical procedures.
I've needed that.
And prescription drugs.
That too.
Thousands of Marylanders can get quality health coverage just by signing up. And there's a special number for Maryland. Just call 211 to find out if you and your family are eligible.
Call 211. Governor, the teams are playing against the Redskins this year. Are they eligible?
Why do you ask?
Because they're going to need it.
If you're a Maryland resident and uninsured, call 211 to see if you're eligible. This is a public service message from Maryland Health Care for All, Care First Blue Cross Blue Shield, and AARP.
Hi, I'm Governor Martin O'Malley.
And I'm Ed Reed, safety for the Ravens.
Last year, we passed a new law that expands the state medical assistance program to make a lot more people eligible for health care coverage, including doctor's visits, medical procedures, and prescription drugs.
That's smooth, Governor.
So there are now 100,000 people in our state who can now, for the first time, obtain health insurance coverage just by signing up.
That's tight, Governor.
And there's a special for citizens in Baltimore City. Just call 311 to find out if you and your family are eligible.
That's cool, Gov. I mean, Governor.
That's good, right?
I mean, that's great. All of you who don't have health insurance, just call 311.
That's what I'm talking about.
This is a public service message from Baltimore Healthcare Access and Healthcare for All. Non-city residents call BHCA at 410-649-0500.
And the AARP.
That's it, folks.
Okay. Let's have a hand for Vinny and all of our presenters. We have 10 minutes for questions, so I won't ask mine. I want you to ask yours. And there's a microphone, so if you just get up, line up, and try to avoid too much editorial comment, and so you can get as many questions as possible.
Just a quick question. Can you get access to your presentations, the two presentations? Are they available, or do they come from you?
I believe they are available.
They are available.
Charlene has them, but...
Charlene Bright has them, and we'll make sure that that we have a way. I just don't know exactly what to say now, but I'm sure they'll be available on from APHA.
And one quick question. Where do you see health at the first speaker, I apologize?
It's Regina.
Where do you see health education and health in this health care reform as far as funding? Where do you see this? And then I do have just one quick comment. We are completely held tight by the media, and how do we address the media with the dollars? There's just no comparison to the dollars that are spent in the anti, especially with Murdoch's machine. Thank you.
Okay, as quick as I can. I can't remember the first question. What was it? Well, that's why I focused on those, because I think health education is very much inside those community transformation grants. That's where I think we're going to see most of the money for health educators. And the second part of that is I really do believe that we have to do this from the grassroots. We don't have that money. Health educators are like really surprised to see $1 million behind anything up here. So we really do need to start at the bottom, showing people how our work is important in the community. And I can talk to you about it afterwards because there's a big one.
Okay. And I do want to just address the question of don't give up because you think the media is weighted on the other side and that the critics have all the weight. I think Vinny shows how powerful you can be with if you have the right message and just a little bit of money and a little bit of creativity. And I was in that business before I was at the Partnership for Prevention, and I remember being told by the tobacco people that there's no way us anti-tobacco people could make a dent on them, and the Truth Campaign, it hurt them, and I was able to create a really good enemy, and I infuriated them, which was the surest evaluation sign of success. So it can be done. Next.
My name is Kim Mitchell. I am a nursing educator. I see the need for a gold cap program and a nursing gold cap. Even though they're educated, once they get out there, they
anybody want to take that?
I think it's absolutely true, and it's, you know, and we've seen the same forces driving people in maldistribution in other health professional fields as well. I think the ground that's been gained with the new legislation is you've got more programs providing support so people don't come into their lower paid work experience with higher debt and no way to get rid of it. So that's one mechanism that I think mitigates a little bit on the pay issue. The other thing I hope happens is that with some cultural shift that goes on as this gets talked about and more embraced as a mainstream part of what's going on in healthcare in the United States, is that the community of working in these places, if there are jobs, of course, in some ways offsets the lower wages. Because we know that the delivery workforce side for the nursing profession has been very troubled. You may get better pay, but people are really unsatisfied. They leave, they get injured, they're, you know, so on and so forth. So we've got to win.
Charlotte Westphal, Upper Peninsula Health Education Corporation, Area Geriatric Scholars, Marquette, Michigan. I have a question for Dr. Rosenstock. You talked about workforce development and three careers, I think. Our program focuses on high school juniors and seniors in placement long-term care sites around rural Upper Peninsula, Michigan, which has an aging population in some parts that exceeds 25% of 65. Short version, how can we get workforce programs incorporated into the healthcare reform as you see some advocacy on the part of the Public Health Association and School of Public Health?
Yes, and I think that is an important point, worthy of more conversation. I think we're seeing little bright lights, but it's a long way to go. So besides the embracing of the need for this continuum and pipeline of education. We did see with some of the first round of funding for the Public Health and Prevention Fund, new money going, new $17 million, it's not huge, but it's new $17 million going to schools of public health to do more community-based health education, to be involved, getting people excited about the field and doing some of this work. So small steps, but a beginning.
Okay. That's good. Two more. Dr. Rosen.
Don't fall off.
Yes, that's right.
My first question to you was the local dependent and caregivers program is one of the things I need. Have you heard people get that money?
Okay, so this is, and I've got the person who's the real expert on the status of that. I'm going to introduce Mike Stevens here, who is in the audience, so he can help me. Right here. This money is available. It's being used. It expands the program and gives some new entitlement for public health. And say more, Mike.
Yes, hi. It's called the DeMarco Factor, Transforming Public Will into Political Power.
Okay, thank you. I'll speak to you afterwards.
Okay.
Okay, good. Last question.
Okay, well, I'm sorry if I gave the impression that it's through the same conduits. Not through the same conduits, but the same type of thematic. So policy change, evidence-based, environmental change. And by the way, in those community transformation grants, state and local governments have a crack at the money, so do the CBOs. So does that make you feel a little bit better? Okay, good. And while I still have the microphone, just in case you can't get my presentation, my email address is
this all right?
Healthprof, like a health professor. My husband set this up. healthprof@comcast.net. Just let me know, I'll send it to you. Healthprof, P-R-O-F as in Frank, at comcast.net.
Okay, they were giving me the, you know, that, so real quick. That's a little bit of advocacy right there.
Really good point. So there is some call out for the school centers in the Affordable Care Act, and I know there's a lot of variability. I know in my own School of Public Health, we have some active engagement with the Los Angeles Unified School District. We do it more on nutrition, and I think the need to expand it and maybe do more comprehensive mechanisms to allow those alliances would be very helpful.
Okay. Just before I end, I want to say, to the terms of another point from the research survey I did earlier, we tested different framings for the prevention message. Almost all the, you know, these are very popular now to test different frames. How do we frame the message? 2 points. One is that all the frames work pretty well. Talk about economic, the prosperity of the community. You can talk about a lot of different things that basically work. The thing that worked the best is to frame it around children. Their health and their future. So just sort of another point. And finally, and another person had asked me about how, at the plenary session, it's asked, what's our message? And how do we talk about the social determinants model in a coherent way to the public? There's an excellent study that's available on the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation website on how to talk about a social determinants model in a way that the public can really understand and grasp. So I just want to recommend that to you, because we've been talking about advocacy and framing as well as education and outreach and education. I thought it was important. But I also want to end by saying thank you so much to our panelists. They were great presentations, and there were great questions from you as well. And let's get after it. It's implementation time. Thanks very much.